This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
My name's Mike Pickering. Thank you all for coming to see me today. It's a great turnout, I must say, for what is should be a very interesting discussion revolving around two very, very interesting exhibitions. Quite clearly I'm biased for the exhibitions, but I think you'll all agree that the bias is justified. First of all, of course, I would like to acknowledge the Ngambri and Ngunnawal peoples of the ACT and surrounds, who are crucial to the museum's operations. They are partners in everything we do, as was has certainly been supported by Matilda House's very, very generous welcoming of both the artists for Yawarrikuju and also for Yallingborough here into Canberra. It's greatly appreciated by the museum and greatly appreciated by the artists to know that they're welcome on Ngambri and Ngunnawal country. The event is being recorded for our audio on demand program. We will be having a question and answer session at the end, at which time we'll have a roving mic. So would you please wait until the microphone is brought up to you before you start talking, and wait till the mic is there. Otherwise, the question won't appear on the recording and just leads to breaks. I do have the advantage, of course, as the MC, of being able to throw in a few statements. I think these exhibitions are fantastic, not just because I work here, but because they're just so full of rich cultural information and they tell stories. I don't want to preempt the speakers who are going to address the exhibitions and what they have in common and their differences much more detail. But to the idea of having these exhibitions and the many themes they engage with, they're not just one theme exhibitions. They have many themes, including relationships to country, relationships with the dreaming and sacred ancestors, relationships with family, relations with place, but also changes in art styles which reflect a continuing tradition of changing. I'm also capable of, in this abusive privilege, of throwing in a few questions without expecting immediate answers. One is the concept of Aboriginal art as ethnographic. It's become de rigueur to condemn people for saying for treating Aboriginal art as ethnographic. But I'm curious about when did ethnographic become a dirty word, since all art is ethnographic, and it does or should tell something about the cultural and social context of the artists. The other question I have, of course, is, why do we, I mean art galleries and art collectors in particular, impose Western taxonomies on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art? Just because something looks abstract doesn't mean it is. I already have answers to these questions, and not surprisingly, they agree with my own opinions. But I like to think, you know, that in these discussions, we can throw up some curly questions to our two speakers here and see what we can stimulate. A quick introduction. I don't think our speakers need introductions to anyone who's been involved with the museum. Certainly we have Professor Howard Morphy, sort of a national, international expert in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art. Has written extensively on the subject matter, of course, and I recommend Howard's writings to everyone because they're so easy to read. You know, they're not obscure. The language is not obscure. Go and get a book and you won't actually understand what the anthropologist is saying. Howard is excellent at writing for a public audience. So, yes. And then we have John Carty. John is both a student but also a professional and practising anthropologist. Was a critical co-curator in the Canning Stock Route project, Yawarrikuju. Is now working for the museum while studying. So, as I said before, in private, I don't want to intimidate John, but he can speak openly and freely at this conference, or this discussion, knowing that his entire future rests in the hands of Howard and myself. So on that basis, I'd ask you all to get your pens and paper for writing down questions you want to ask. I will open up the discussion and hand over to John.
There's no pressure there, is there? Okay. Understanding Aboriginal art in 10 minutes, which is what I was given, but I'm going to try and get a bit more out of Mike through some sweet looks and batting my eyelids halfway through. This is going to be a long 10 minutes because I'm going to start by stating unequivocally that we do not understand Aboriginal art. Or rather, often, we don't understand it in the way that artists hope that we will or that they allow for us to do so. And that's because we don't really understand what it is that people are painting. We don't understand country. And I think Yalambara and Yuwarrakuchu are two exhibitions that seek to help us see and to understand, but for me, most importantly, to feel the importance of country. And now, I can't comment in detail on Yalambara. I've only seen it for the first time yesterday, but the resonances with Yuwarrakuchu are quite extraordinary in many ways. And I can't even comment in any detail in this 9.5 minutes on Yuwarrakuchu. But what I want to do is use one or two Western Desert paintings from Yuwarrakuchu to open up the terrain and the conversation that that exhibition and I think also Yalambara addresses. And one painting that I want to discuss is this big pink beauty from Patrick Djungerai. It's a classic example of contemporary Western Desert art painted by one of the most acclaimed painters of our times. It is also impossible to understand just by looking at it. This is not a comment on the inscrutability of the artwork, as you'll soon see, but a reflection upon some conventions that attend and obscure the reception of Aboriginal art. Unfortunately, not knowing what Mike was going to say now, I think I'm about to agree with him. For the past 30 years, if not longer, curators and collectors and writers have fought extremely hard to have Aboriginal art recognised as fine art, as contemporary art, as the equal of any great art produced anywhere at any time. And apart from a few rogue nations still grappling with their own primitive instincts, I think we won that battle. Yet the battle lines endure. And part of that battle over the past decades was about distinguishing art from the ethnographic objects analysed by anthropologists and collected by museums. Art belongs in a gallery, and these objects are to be treated differently. They'll mostly be on white walls with minimal text or context to detract or distract from the power of the aesthetic art object. In recently opening the most important and expansive display of Aboriginal art in this country, the director of the National Gallery of Australia reiterated the divide that the art world positions itself and Aboriginal art against. And this is a quote from Ron Radford from the opening of the galleries at the NGA a couple of months ago. He says, "The galleries are rooms consciously and unapologetically designed for the permanent collection of Indigenous art, not for anthropology." End quote. We're inhabiting an interesting moment in the history of Aboriginal art right now, and I think Howard might argue that that moment has been going on for some decades. It's not something that I've discovered today, but it's a moment in which the tensions between anthropology and art, between galleries and museums, their roles and ideologies are being played out on the shifting terrain of painted country. I think what we want to avoid in this, though, is an institutional fixing of positions, particularly one where art requires a white wall and anthropology is positioned as a murky synonym for content. And my concern here is not to defend anthropology, but to defend art from the complacency that often attends equality. It's risky to assume that simply because Aboriginal art has become part of the furniture in our galleries and in our homes, that we somehow understand it any better than when it wasn't. It's not accurate or helpful to conflate the content of a painting with some ethnographic framework, as if these modes of understanding were somehow inherently opposed to the intent of the artist. The intent of most Western Desert artists that I know is to show us their country. And the expectation, generous but often grossly mistaken, is that by seeing these paintings we somehow understand the importance and complexity of that gift. To be shown something in desert culture is to have knowledge revealed to you. It is a gift, but often an inscrutable one. I can't count the number of times desert friends have taken me to an important place and said, after 2 seconds there, "You've seen it? Now you know. And little green anthropologist sitting there going, there's no rule book. I don't understand. I don't know. And I think it's the same with art. The premise of Uwarrakuchu is that we use a non-Indigenous road, the Canning Stock Route, as the meeting point, as the cross-cultural scaffolding on which to develop an understanding of country. Uwarrakuchu is as much about curating an audience as it is about curating an exhibition. To understand Australian history, you have to understand the country that it happened within. To understand these paintings, you have to understand in some way the country they depict. This exhibition doesn't teach people about history or about art, but it equips them with some basic entry points and tools for understanding country, which is still an elusive concept to so many of us, anthropologists included. But through Uwarrakuchu, we try and give people some common touchstones like family and the dreaming and just the simple concept of home to help them pull apart this idea of country and recognise themselves and their own understanding of the world within it. And the most obvious thing, of course, is the dreaming, and every exhibition in some way has to address this. But most exhibitions don't actually explain, and most people don't actually understand what the dreaming is. We take it for granted as if it's non-problematic. It's commonly assumed that all Western desert paintings are about the Jukurpa in the desert, which is the dreaming, the creation period in Aboriginal cosmology during which ancestral beings moved across the land singing, fighting, loving, killing each other, stealing, having fun. And as they travelled, they created the features of the land, and they also established the moral, practical and spiritual laws that continue to govern Aboriginal societies. These Jukurpa narratives form an intricate network of dreaming tracks or song lines that crisscross the desert country. And this is a map that was produced out of the Form Canning Stock Route project that led to the Uwarrakuchu exhibition. And it shows a northern, just a small cross-section of the northern Canning Stock Route. That's Canning's map underneath. And across it is just a small survey of the dreaming tracks that run across that country or that pre-existed, you know, the line that Canning drew in the sand. And it was the knowledge of these songs that allowed people to navigate their way through the desert, both physically and spiritually, finding water, food and meaning in their desert world. It makes sense that such narratives, such maps, are an integral part of the economic and cultural strategies of desert artists today. Now, Patrick Djungari paints one of the major dreamings of the desert country, the Dingari line, which is this. I've always wanted to use one of these. This line here. I now feel like an academic. And it runs parallel to, if you imagine this map as, that's the southern end of it, of the painting, and that's the northern end. It's actually painting the country from well 33 in the south up to Balgo and Billaluna in the north, the northern end of the Canning Stock Route. So it's about half of the Canning Stock Route country. And this is the east, and the top side of the painting is the west. It is this line, this dreaming, which Patrick paints predominantly for the art market. And the story for it is usually relatively brief, because of the restricted nature of the dreaming. And there is then, it would seem, not much for the audience to understand of Patrick's art, other than the fact that it's great art. But this painting changes that and challenges that. During the research for the Form Canning Stock Route project, Patrick accompanied this painting, as he was painting it, with a series of oral histories that illuminate his country and artistry in revelatory ways. The first point to recognise is that he folded this Dingari line, this the concentric squares, which is a classic Dingari iconography. He actually folded it up into the country to show the Canning Stock Route. So this line here is actually the Canning Stock Route. And as he unfolded this line out into the painting, he also unpacked his memory as we were driving through the desert, rolling this painting up, unrolling it each day and painting it at different sites along the Canning Stock Route during the project. The first point that he made about this painting was that as a young man, he and his brother used to walk around this dingery country here, but they would walk over to the Stock Route to meet up with family and you know, have adventures of their own in the desert. But also that Patrick himself, as a young man, eventually walked out of this country up to Balgo after his family all left from Well 40, which is Ngatawalu, where the famous story of helicopter being picked up by the helicopter and being flown up to Balgo, which if any of you have been in the exhibition, you'll know. Patrick was actually there, but he was a young man on his law business and he couldn't travel with the other people in the family. So he had to wait behind and walk up by himself as a young man up out of the desert. So the Canning Stock Route, and he used the wells of the Canning Stock Route to guide him up to Balgo. And so it's this life journey embodied in this line. But layered within that is another kind of history, which is Patrick's knowledge of what happened at these places. And Patrick enumerated events that are not in the history books. He enumerated, I'm not going to point at the exact right well each time because I can't count, but at Well 37, he told narratives about his family killing a white man there who was prospecting for oil. At Well 41, he narrated the story of Peter Goodigy's family, who was a Fitzroy Crossing artist whose family was massacred there for killing a camel. And everyone was killed. Peter Goodigy was the only one who got away as a young boy after watching his family massacred from being hidden from beneath Spinifex. At Well 47, and Well 50, Patrick narrates another series of massacres that aren't recorded in the history books. And these conflicts, like so many on Australia's frontier, are missing from the annals of history because they weren't written down. But they are not forgotten. And the value of such a painting is not, however, in simply filling the gaps or correcting the facts of Australian history. What is important is the way those events and our history are imagined and remembered through alternative worldviews to provide a different perspective not only on the past, but of what that past continues to mean to desert people today. It also adds an extraordinary dimension to this painted country that has been hitherto entirely absent from Patrick's reception and reputation as a fine artist. As the dreaming shadows history in this painting, this is a country just marbled with parallel visions. Through the transference of the iconography of the Tingeri squares, Patrick absorbs the Canning Stock Route wells into an abiding Aboriginal understanding and vision of the desert. And the squares are multivalent themselves, just as they absorb the Stock Route into the desert. They also poetically conflate Patrick's historical journey along the CSR as a young man with the mythic quests of the Tingeri men, transposing sacred ancestral itineraries with his own without collapsing the difference is to me an act of great Australian poetry and artistic significance. You could argue that Patrick's painting is unique. Most people don't paint these great dreaming narratives over vast distances. Most people don't document multiple historical events in one painting, and most people don't feel authorised to paint this much. However, everyone paints combinations of this kind of content when they paint their country, because the dreaming is inseparable from the land, inseparable from family, from history, and the currents of your own life. While Uarakuchu as a whole presents a vast political tapestry of dreamings, individual paintings return us to the often overlooked intimacy of desert art. Millie Kelly's tiny brown painting here, which is, I think, maybe my favourite in the whole exhibition. You know, it's rough and rusted, and it has a little yellow arc in the corner. And this was Millie's home, the shelter that she lived in as a girl with her family. And it was these homes that colonial history interrupted. For Aboriginal people, the creation of the Canning Stock Route and the sinking of the wells, the coming of the drovers, did not happen in time, as we commonly think of it, but in place. Events do not just happen in the desert, they happen here or there, in the Noora, or country that people paint. And like Millie, most artists paint relatively small areas of country. Now this, in some essence, this is just one square in Patrick's painting. That's a bit of a neat analogy, but that's effectively what it is. Most people don't paint, or most people paint relatively small areas of country to which they're intimately associated, their waters and the events, ancestral and otherwise, that have come to give meaning to those places. It was these waters that the stock route usurped and those stories that it stumbled into. Sometimes these worlds did not merely overlap, you know, they collided, and there's many examples of that in Uwatakuchu. And like the bones that Patrick remembers scattered at Well 41, that conflict becomes sediment in the story of the country, pigment in the colour of these paintings. As such, you don't need to paint half the Western Desert like Patrick to exhibit this complexity. And I want to end here with one final painting. This is by Lily Long, and it's a painting of Diwa, or Well 26 on the Canning Stock Route. And it provides a final example of a place where personal, historical and ancestral threads entwine around a single site. This is the Canning Stock Route, Lily starts her story. And we're invited to imagine ourselves with Lily as a child, perched on the hill, watching the drovers come in when she was a girl for the first time, watching 500 head of cattle come and drink at this squared-off well. And you can see that the rounded soaks that, you know, Lily's family used to drink at, and then this squared-off Canning Stock Route well with the Canning Stock Route there. And Lily talks about sitting here as a young girl and watching the drovers and being terrified and not knowing what the hell these cattle were sitting around at her country and running away. And then other parts of the story that she narrates is of these hills here. And as she's describing that domestic narrative, she starts to describe the story of an ancestral woman here who was trying to kill the Wadi Kujara, these important dreaming figures in this part of the country. And that woman was trying to poison those two men in the dreaming. And effectively, she ended up becoming these hills there. And then Lily, in another part of the story for this painting, says, oh, and by the way, my uncle was also poisoned by drovers on the Canning Stock Route. It's an extraordinary, condensation of these layers of meaning into one completely unified image of a place. And through one place, these threads of memory, art and country, history and dreaming are interwoven. And in this place-based view of the world presented by artists like Lily Long and Patrick, stories from the Jukapa, from family, from colonial history and from personal experience are all layered in the sites where they happened, where they continue to happen in contemporary art. Country is a kind of memory. And our engagement with country through exhibitions such as Uwatakuchu and Yalambara, where we are encouraged not simply to look at paintings, but to walk around inside the country that they create for us, is crucial to a broader kind of memory, both personal and political, of what it means to even be living in Australia today. Thank you.
I'll just take the opportunity to remind people that the Patrick, well, both paintings, of course, but the Patrick Jungerei painting is on display in the Canning Stock Route Uwarakuju exhibition. But also, if you go and look at it, do go into the theatreette because we have Patrick talking to that painting and describing those stories. And that, again, it's the stories that bring that painting to life, at least from a museum perspective. I'll just make him, before I hand over to Howard, intrigued by the idea of we have the map of the dreaming tracks as recorded in a Western convention, and they tend to imply that you have the colour which shows the dreaming tracks, then you have places of non-colour. So that may imply to people, you know, the non-Indigenous people that there are places without dreamings. But in reality, it's how we map the country versus how Aboriginal people have mapped the country, which is the whole country is saturated with those colours. And that's what I think, again, comes out in the Patrick Jungerei painting, is there's no distinction between here and there. Everything merges one into the other. So thank you very much, John. And now I shall immediately hand over to Professor Howard Morphy to continue the discussion with regard to Northeast.
I was wondering, is it possible to switch the lights off the screen so that it's not quite so bright, or is that not possible?
I have no idea.
Because that might show the images better.
Ah. Save that one up, didn't it?
Okay, thank you very much. Yarlingborough is a place. It's a very dramatic landscape. It's in eastern Arnhem Land on the Gulf of Carpentaria, and you approach it as a huge chain of sand dunes that separate the sea from the inland. It's also the landing place of the Jankau sisters, two of the great creative ancestors of northeast Arnhem Land, and it's in the country of the Riritu clan. I'll give some instances of their journey as I go on with this talk. But this is really a painting by Maolung Marika that has an important place in the history of Aboriginal art, because it was one of the paintings collected by Tony Tuckson and Stuart Scougal from Yirrkala in 1959. And it was one of the first sets of paintings and carvings that, I guess, breached the walls of an art gallery in Australia. So the great collections made by Scougal and Tuckson really had pride of place for a while in the forecourt of the Art Gallery of New South Wales. They then took a back seat for a while, but they're now again exactly in that place now. Times have changed, and what was really challenged at the time when Tuckson and Scougal made this collection, indeed it was said by many of the reviewers, this should actually not be in an art gallery, this should be in the Australian Museum or some other museum, is no longer the kind of argument that can be put forward. Though as late as the 1980s, the Art Gallery of New South Wales was thinking that perhaps these wonderful paintings could have been transferred to a museum. I'm sure it's a great regret to the Australian Museum in some ways that they weren't transferred to them. But this painting by Maolung represents the great creative acts of the Jankars who gave birth to the clans of Yolngu people, in particular of the Dua Moiety. And this is an extraordinary painting, really, of this incredible act of birthing, where you can see here, the male and female children of the Dua Moiety clans. The act of birth took place at one of the waterholes that they created. When they landed in eastern Arnhem Land, they had with them a whole series of sacred objects that they'd brought with them, and they had two great digging sticks called Maolung. These great digging sticks they used both to get food but also to get water by digging wells in the ground, and then they actually helped themselves create food by planting the digging sticks around the waterhole, and they then grew into the trees that surround the waterhole, and then covering themselves with ngainmara mats, woven mats, they then gave birth to the clans. And you'll see in the exhibition very much at the centre there's a beautiful woven mat, and this signals the fact that in many contexts the category that Yolngu would include as sacred objects or medayan or manifestations of the ancestral past, as well as paintings and painted designs such as this, will include ceremonial digging sticks, will include dilly bags, and will include apparently mundane functionary mats that could be used to shade people from the heat of the sun, or in this particular context to provide modesty in giving birth. Now, the exhibition Yarlingborough really was the idea of Bundak Marika, who then collaborated with Margie West of the Northern Territory Museums and Art Galleries then, who may be here later on, if she's not here already in the audience somewhere. And Bundak was the daughter of Maolung. This is Maalung, Arika. This is actually a palimpsest of the painting we've just seen, but it's actually Maalung painting himself looking at one of the great digging stick sacred objects that is named after him. Bundak was Maalung's youngest child, and Bundak went on a quest to discover all of the paintings and objects that the Rirachinu clan and related clans had made over a period since European intensive colonization, which in northeast Arnhem Land was in 1935 with the founding of the mission station at Yirrkala. From the very beginning, Yolngu were producing paintings, paintings for sale to Europeans, but paintings also to persuade Europeans of the value of their culture and as an educational resource. And those paintings, those objects, photographs, sound recordings, films, became distributed in museums around Australia. And Bundak thought it would be wonderful if I and my brother Maalung, sorry, my nephew Maalung, named after his grandfather, went and really documented all of these and brought them back in images to Yirrkala. And at the same time, they were making Yellingborough as a place part of the national estate, as something that they thought was fundamentally important, not only to Yolngu, but to Australia. So, and Bundak, when she was involved in this project, didn't initially think an exhibition was necessarily going to be the outcome. It could be an outcome. She thought that a book could be an outcome. And a book was the thing that was produced first. And in the beginning of this book, she said what she was trying to do through going around and bringing all of these things together was to create something that was like that film Ian Dunlop made in memory of Maalung. So one of the interesting things that that then poses, in what sense did Bundak see the book, see the exhibition that we'll be able to see later, as like Ian Dunlop's film In Memory of Maalung? In what sense is an exhibition or a collection of paintings like a film? Well, the film was a film of a memorial ceremony. I hope that they'll be able to screen it in the museum. In memory of her father, that reenacted the great events of the Jankau's lives in Yolngu's ceremonial performance. And in a way, the reason that it is the same is that, in fact, these paintings, these objects, the songs, the dances associated with them, are all manifestations, all evidences of the ancestral past, and they're all, in Yolngu terms, seen really in the context of action in different places, in different times, that Yolngu themselves can bring together for particular purposes, whether it's a circumcision ceremony, a burial ceremony, or a memorial ceremony. So when Yolngu think of these things, they look at them both in terms of the past, present, and future. And in the past, though that past is an ancestral past that is here in the present and will be there in the future, this is one of the sacred dilly bags that the Jankau sisters hung on a tree. This is a crayon drawing produced for the anthropologist Ronald Burnt by Maalung. And this just shows the journey of the Jankau sisters from Buralco, the land of the morning star, over in the sea to the east, beyond Papua New Guinea, in some imaginary distant country. And this is the journey that they took to these great sand dunes of Yellingborough that you see at the top. And this representation of this journey that happened in the past is made up in part of a whole series of separate paintings that represent different named places on the way. Different name places in the sea, places where they saw a group of ducks flying from the surface of the sea as they approached the land, an area where there were flying foxes suspended in the trees on the shore that they heard, a place there where they saw a goanna in the sand dunes, and a place where they got sunburnt by the heat of the sun, a place again where they saw goannas playing in the sand. So these are all, if you like, paintings which mark places on the journey. And each of those is associated with songs, with dances, and with sacred objects. So one of the things that these paintings, that the sacred dilly bags, that the digging sticks represent or are manifestations of, is this ancestral dimension that underlies the present, that gave birth to the clans, and that is the possibility of renewing the presence of the ancestors today and into the future. And in the context of performances today, they are reenactments of the Jankau sisters. Now, I'm going to show a very interesting performance here, because this is the first, when you see this in the museum, this is the first Yellingborough exhibition opening in our understanding of that word. This, though, is a performance in the chief, in the administrator's house in the Northern Territory in Darwin, where they launched the book that preceded the exhibition by a year, a book that hoped that an exhibition would come, a book that was also associated with a conference in which many of the Rirratjingu clan were present and talking and communicating about the Jankau. And this was to open that particular event. It was a dance performance that is very similar to the dance performance that yesterday the Rirratjingu were able to open this exhibition. And here you can see women dancing the ancestral Jankau. And this is the digging stick that I was talking about. This is the Maolung. This is that object that the artist Maolung was looking at when he painted himself reflecting on his identity in relation to his country and in relation to Yellingborough. And here is his namesake, Maolung number 2, a great Yolngu artist of today who was one of the leading dancers yesterday when the exhibition was opened. Sadly, they all had to return today. I was hoping that people would have been able to stay on, but they, in terms of the planes and schedules, have gone back. And here are Yolngu women reenacting the process of the Jankau sisters giving birth, moving their digging sticks into the ground, creating the well around which the children were born. So you can see in the exhibition how important it was that Yolngu performed at the opening ceremony. Yolngu don't perform at an opening ceremony simply because you know, they wish for a public spectacle. I mean, Yolngu are very conscious that their dance forms are very persuasive. But in a sense, if an exhibition doesn't open with a performance that relates to its significance and meaning, it is seen by Yolngu to be very much impoverished. So in a way, the dance performance puts all of these objects into action, places them into a different space and time. And finally, these paintings are very much part of the future. This is a painting of associated with the Jankau sisters that is being done on a boy's chest in a Yolngu circumcision ceremony 2 years ago, because the initiates are incorporated into this ancestral dimension through ceremonial performance. And the aesthetics of Yolngu art is part of the creation, the endowment of ancestral power, and the transformation or transfer of that power from one generation to the next. And Yolngu art as a system is one that is a system in action. It's a system that is able to be adapted to very different kind of circumstances. It was remarkable, the ceremony at the administrator's house in Darwin was actually supposed to take place outside in a very large sort of garden. There was this most colossal thunderstorm that happened just at the moment that was supposed to be opened, and everybody moved immediately inside, and the ceremony took part in the verandas that surround the house. And yesterday's ceremony, Yolngu arrived with no rehearsals, and while, in a sense, rehearsing by doing some preliminary songs, were able to create a performance that led people around and into the exhibition as a whole. But the individual artworks themselves are part of a process of dynamic continuity, education in art, but also tremendous innovations. This is one of the first paintings collected from North East Island Land, a painting by Mao Lung of the sand dunes at Yallingborough. This is a print made by Bunduk of exactly that same place, reflecting the fact that it's on one side of the sand dunes rather than the other side that's associated with the sunset rather than the sunrise. But if we had more time, we would be able to see strong similarities. But I'll just point out the fact that this is made of these intersecting, cross-cutting, parallel lines, which are a sign of Yallingborough as a place. And there you can see what I'm meaning there. And finally, a painting by Wanyapi Marika, that is in the exhibition, I think, but a very similar one, if not this very one. And this is a painting of their long journey from the land of the Morning Star to Yallingborough. Because what they did was they followed the light of the Morning Star. They paddled their canoe, and many of the songs evoke the sound of the canoe being paddled through those waters. The songs go mumutun, 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 as the paddles go one after the other. And this is the impact of the paddle in the water lit by the light of the Morning Star. As the paddle goes in, as the water, in this case relatively still, is fractured by the effect of the paddle, it ripples out and gradually goes back to the smooth incoming of a gentle tide. So here you can see Yolngu art is used to create aesthetic effects that can translate cross-culturally unproblematically, but in a sense need that guidance to go with them that Yolngu have always sent with their paintings. They send it in the form of their own dances, which if people will sort of follow the movements can begin to get ideas about what it is, but also in the documentation that goes with their paintings. Yolngu do not see the meaning of art or its cultural significance in any way separated from its aesthetic power. And I suppose that goes somewhere to answering Mike's question in a way that is very has much in common with John's answer. So I'll finish at that point. Thanks.
And thank you, Howard. I think certainly Howard brings it to the fore, but also with John's is you can appreciate the difficulty in a museum of trying to convey that complexity and condense that complexity of culture through art or through any object or into an exhibition. An exhibition is simply just the tip of the iceberg, and it's a real challenge as to not only conveying the message but also conveying the enthusiasm and life. And in both cases with the Yawarrkudju and with Yallingborough, we were remarkably privileged to have a number of the artists or the families of the artists, people who were authorised to talk to those works and to sing to those works present at the opening. And in doing their ceremony, although many people couldn't be there yesterday or for the other openings as well, they seem to leave a vitality in the exhibition that persists long after they've left. And we're remarkably privileged, and we hope we can continue doing that in the future. And also to make sure that the voice you hear when you come to our exhibitions is the voice of the artists, the voices of the culture that has produced those works, first and foremost. We'll move perhaps now into questions and comments. Let's have a bit of controversy here. Look on, let's change the thing. We have roving microphones. As the microphones come round, you're welcome to, it is being recorded. You are welcome to identify yourself if you wish. If you prefer to remain anonymous, that's fine too. It will help. Please keep, we want to get as many views across the audience as possible, so don't persist in sort of long comments if you can help it, okay? All right.
I just wanted to follow up with John on his point that we're not able to understand the art in the way that artists might wish. Do you think this is something peculiar to Indigenous art, or is it a fact of life of all art, and it's just that the distance between what the artist might intend and what the viewer might receive is greater, perhaps, in Indigenous art?
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it, but I also think that if you want to understand Jackson Pollock, you go and educate yourself. You go and read 18 books. You go and read The Shock of the New. You go and read, catalogues. You educate yourself about modern art. You have a commonality with that cultural tradition in the West, but you go and learn about art so you understand what that extraordinary painting is about. And I think that there is a disjunct in Australia where we assert that the way to respect Aboriginal art is to just acknowledge it as great art, when I think that the art history that's required to appreciate these paintings actually involves a lot of what people pejoratively call anthropology, which it shouldn't be anthropology. It's just about educating yourself and learning about what the artist is painting, which is all of these things that we're talking about, which is country, to learn about Aboriginal understandings of family, of the dreaming, and not take those concepts for granted, as you wouldn't take cubism for granted. You go and learn what cubism is. And so I think it's just about the way that we frame Aboriginal art as in many ways we try and give it equality and say it's great art, but we don't actually treat it with the same respect art historically. And I think that's one of the main points I would make about that.
Next. Anyone?
That about covered it, didn't it?
Someone got there.
Sorry, missed someone. Someone else got a question. Up.
No, not him.
Peter Thorley. It's not a Dorothy Dixer, I'm sure.
Peter Thorley. You said these paintings, John, Howard might like to comment on this as well, these paintings are mostly about country. Would you feel comfortable describing them as landscapes?
Thank you. Howard would, probably, more so than I. I think it depends on what you understand as landscape. I think that the idea of landscape is not what I'm talking about with these paintings, but I think that Western landscapes are, in fact, invested with all of this cosmology, mythology, Western perspectives on the universe are encoded in Western landscapes. So they are not just... they're not naked artistic practices. And so in some ways, the relationship between landscape and Aboriginal paintings of country is more nuanced and more interesting. But I guess my answer at the moment, and that might change over time, is that I actually think that these paintings of country are closer to what we understand as paintings of portraiture, as objectifications of the self through the medium of the land of which you're a part. So I lean to in the pendulum of landscape portraiture. I think Aboriginal art, from the desert at least, is my understanding of it, I think it's closer to this notion of portraiture, self-portraiture through land. But Howard will disagree.
Howard certainly wouldn't call them landscape. Unless you call Sidney Nolan's Kelly series landscape or something like that. I mean, I think that the whole point is that landscape refers to a particular genre of painting where the focus was actually on land in association with a particular view that developed in the sort of 18th and 19th century in relation to how one would portray that. And so it's almost a word that's quite difficult to apply to most sort of complex art forms. And I think, I mean, I probably wouldn't call it portraiture either, but I can see very strongly that there are elements of portraiture in some of those paintings, almost literally in the case of Mao Lung painting his self in that particular painting, which gives a real clue to the sense in which Yolngu do see these as part of their identity. And an identity that they connect into the future. And I think it's very important to recognise the enormous diversity in Aboriginal art, just as we recognise diversity in our, and diversity both within the same sort of cultural tradition, such as Yolngu, but also between. So if we were giving lectures on that other great collection that was made by Scougal, Tiwi Pukamani poles, we would find it very difficult to talk about it in the terms that we've been talking about these paintings here. There are actually great similarities, I think, between Yolngu artistic tradition and that of the peoples of the Western Desert, even though the iconography and the all sorts of techniques and so are very different. But in the case of Pukamani poles, people have tried to force Pukamani poles into these represent ancestral beings in a particular place, on a particular journey, and so on and so forth. But really, that is not how they were and are seen, understood, commissioned by Tiwi for their own ceremonies. There's much more an emphasis there on aspects of the sort of expressive dimension of those poles in relation to ideas of persons and mourning and loss and the vibrancy of life, a whole series of things that are actually much more metaphysical. Those metaphysical things exist in Yolngu paintings as well, but there isn't that kind of narrative associated with the art of Tiwi that there would be in Northeast Island Land. So I think we've got to really recognise that there is this incredible, rich diversity.
And I will exercise the MC's prerogative and just interrupt at this point to say that I believe they are both landscapes and portraiture. Remembering, of course, that my publications in Indigenous art constitute a 500-word article about a message stick. And the reason is, landscapes are all culturally constructed. They're not synonymous with environment. You're not seeing what is actually there. The artist situates themselves to reproduce something that encapsulates or captures the values that they want to see represented through that landscape. So, you know, I'll sit here, I can't see the valley, I'm going to move to the left. You move to the left, get out from behind the tree, you can see the valley. All landscapes are therefore, you know, they're culturally constructed by the values of the artist or the artist's culture. In terms of portraiture, I remember the discussion we had with the portrait gallery was how could they represent Aboriginal culture through the portrait gallery when they didn't have that many portraits of Aboriginal people. And we had a discussion about a portrait, a head and shoulders will tell you what a person looks like, but these sorts of artworks will tell you what how a person feels that they are. This, you know, this is what I look like, but this is who I am. And that's expressed with the spirituality. Now, they're not exclusive, of course. It's not an either-or situation. There are multiple levels of interpretation. And now, fortunately, I can run on to the next question and I don't have to respond to anyone in that question.
I very much agree with the notion that all art, whether it's Western or Aboriginal, has culture built into it. I was always intrigued by looking at Glover and Augustus Earle, their early paintings of Australia, which they brought their English culture to it, and it doesn't look very much like we now understand Australian painting towards the end of the century. When I went to the NGA extension of the Aboriginal paintings, I was absolutely knocked out by it, and I was knocked out by the quality of it in art terms. So my question is, allowing and to some extent understanding the argument between anthropology and art, how do you judge the quality of a painting in terms of good and bad artistically? because my favourite painter, Emily, excuse me for not being able to pronounce her second name, but when she was here, she absolutely knocked me out artistically.
I don't really think that there's any difference between eventually making assessments of quality with Aboriginal art or Papua New Guinea art or Byzantine art or contemporary Australian art. What one actually has to do is have both a body of knowledge and criteria for making judgments. Now, that's an extremely complex thing to do when one's looking at things across place, time and culture. The reason I can say this with a degree of confidence is that I think that in the Yolngu case, the kinds of judgments that Yolngu make about quality are very analogous to the kinds of judgments that in the end, once non-Aboriginal people, European people in particular, start to appreciate the art of Northeast Arnhem Land, are going to map on to quite a considerable extent. Initially, if you're looking at art that you're completely unfamiliar with, then you won't have any basis or means of making judgments. So, I mean, when there are new movements in Western art, it's the classic time when 90% of people will say, this is rubbish, my children could do better, this is crazy, an ape could do it. And then after a period of time, when a degree of knowledge, appreciation, when people look at it and begin to develop criteria of judgment that relates to that particular art style, then people are going to be starting to make, if you like, informed judgments that are about things that are quite sort of qualitative. So the kind of artists who Yolngu will argue, please do the painting on my son's chest in his circumcision ceremony, are the ones that in the market context, most art galleries will say, this is a painter who's producing paintings of quality. And just like in any art practice, there are works that people produce that are not their best, and they will often acknowledge that that's not their best. I can give just one comment from Narichin Maimaru, who's an artist whose biography I've been writing for about the last 20 years. If I ever have time, I'll finish it. And he was talking about his own paintings and when they were finished. And he said, I can sit here and I can work on this painting for 2 or 3 days, and I'm painting, and I'm not sure, it looks a mess, I can't work it out. Then suddenly, it all comes together. And those are the kind of ways of talking about an artwork, ironically, that can, or maybe not even ironically, that can actually resonate across artists, across cultures. So, John.
Very rude, Sam.
It's always difficult coming after Howard. I don't have a great deal to add to that. I think, I guess in terms of a concrete example, one of the things that we did in the Canning Stockwood exhibition is that we didn't exclude paintings just because they weren't the best paintings. I mean, we wanted it to be a big, sexy, fabulous, persuasive, visceral experience so that you walk in and as you were saying, you're blown away by the quality of these things pulsing on the walls. But that wasn't the only criteria. There are paintings in there that aren't the best work by that artist, but they're an integral part of understanding that story and that country. And so those paintings are in there because of their meaning, their intent, the artistic intent, and the way that hangs together in an experience of that country. And I would, perhaps cheekily suggest that, after you've been blown away in the NGA by all these pretty pictures, you should come over to the NMA and learn about what they're about by going through the Canning Stockwood. That was a bit cheeky. I really like the paintings over there.
It was very cheeky, and your check is in the mail. We're just on 1:30. I'll formally close proceedings because that means I can say I actually held the time. And I think we can continue the discussion afterwards, but that's okay because it's outside of my time. Please go down to the... Well, all this discussion is fresh in your mind. Rush off to the exhibitions while you're here and basically do what I'm going to do and apply it. As I say, there is so much information out there and there's so much we need to know. What we're finding here in the museum is our audiences are coming in and really engaging with that extra content. When they're hearing the stories, the people aren't coming in just to look at nice artworks. They're coming in to engage with those stories, and it's those stories, first and foremost, that sort of enrich the entire exhibition.
On the other hand, I think that if you look at the Yellingborough exhibition, the majority of these paintings are paintings that are in the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and they're exhibited perhaps in a way that they can be appreciated better as art in the space that they're in here at the museum than in the crowded spaces in the Art Gallery of New South Wales where they usually are. So I think that kind of opposition between an art gallery context and a museum context is one of the things that needs to be challenged at the present time. I think we do need really special spaces for viewing art, for viewing beautiful, fine objects in a way that enables one to fully engage with them. But at the same time, I think all art needs to and deserves to be contextualised in other contexts. So I think this opposition is one that we want to get away from.
I'll again interrupt and say I agree. I think we have this lovely little fight going on, this little tension, but the thing is, yeah. One of the problems is that people from an art gallery will go and visit a museum and say, this is wrong, it's too much this, and people from a museum will go to an art gallery and say, that's wrong, there's not enough of this or something else. And the thing is, they're just alternative ways of looking. Each is equal. We need to probably have a look for other, even more alternative ways of presenting and viewing these works in order to really appreciate them. The Uara Kudu exhibition, by the way, the current visitation numbers stand at around the 75,000 mark. It's on its way to being the most popular exhibition that the museum has held in its 10 years. So we're feeling rather pleased with that. So I hope you'll join me in thanking our speakers, and I hope you enjoyed the...
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.